and looked at his wife as she stood by the window in the living room staring out at the water. She had her mobile in her hand, and he knew that she was waiting for a call from Blomqvist. She looked so unhappy that he went over and put his arm around her.
"Blomqvist is a grown man," he said, "but if you're really so worried, you should call that policeman."
Berger sighed.
"I should have done that hours ago, but that's not why I'm unhappy."
"Is it something I should know about?"
"I've been hiding something from you. And from Mikhail. And from everyone else at the magazine."
"Hiding? Hiding what?"
She turned to her husband and told him that she had been offered the job of editor-in-chief at Svenska Morgenposten. Beckman raised his eyebrows.
"But I don't understand why you didn't tell me," he said. "That's a huge coup. Congratulations."
"It's just that I feel like a traitor."
"Mikhail will understand. Everyone has to move on when it's time, and right now it's time for you."
"I know."
"Have you already made up your mind?"
"Yes, I've made up my mind. But I haven't had the guts to tell anybody. And it feels as if I'm leaving in the midst of a huge disaster."
Beckman took his wife in his arms. Armansky rubbed his eyes and looked out into the darkness.
"We ought to call Bublansky," he said.
"No,"
Palmgren said.
"Neither Bublansky nor any other authority figure has ever lifted a finger to help her. Let her take care of her own affairs."
Armansky looked at Salander's former guardian. He was still amazed by the improvement in Palmgren's condition compared with when he last saw him over Christmas. He still slurred his words, but he had a new vitality in his eyes. There was also a fury about the man that Armansky had never seen before. Palmgren told him the whole story that Blomqvist had pieced together. Armansky was shocked.
"She's going to try to kill her father."
"That's possible,"
Palmgren said calmly.
"Or else Zalachenko might try to kill her."
"That's also possible."
"So we're just supposed to wait?"
"Dragan, you're a good person. But what Lisbeth Salander does or doesn't do, whether she survives or whether she dies, is not your responsibility."
Palmgren threw out his arms. All of a sudden he had rediscovered a coordination that he hadn't had in a long time. It was as though the drama of the past few weeks had revived his dulled senses.
"I've never been sympathetic towards people who take the law into their own hands, but I've never heard of anyone who had such a good reason to do so. At the risk of sounding like a cynic, what happens tonight will happen no matter what you or I think. It's been written in the stars since she was born, and all that remains is for us to decide how we're going to behave towards Lisbeth if she makes it back."
Armansky sighed and looked grimly at the old lawyer.
"And if she spends the next 10 years in prison, at least she was the one who chose that path. I'll still be her friend,"
Palmgren said.
"I had no idea you had such a libertarian view of humanity."
"Neither did I,"
he said. Miriam Wu stared at the ceiling. She had the nightlight on, and the radio was playing On a Slow Boat to China at a low volume. The day before she had woken to find herself in the hospital where Paolo Roberto had brought her. She slept and woke restlessly and went to sleep again with no real grasp of passing time. The doctors told her that she had a concussion. In any case, she needed to rest. She had a broken nose, 3 broken ribs and bruises all over her body. Her left eyebrow was so swollen that her eye was merely a slit. It hurt whenever she tried to change position. It hurt when she breathed in. Her neck was painful and she was wearing a brace just to be on the safe side. But the doctors had assured her that she would make a complete recovery. When she awoke towards evening, Paolo Roberto was sitting next to her bed. He grinned and asked how she felt. She wondered if she looked as awful as he did. She asked questions, and he answered them. For some reason it didn't seem at all odd that he was a good friend of Salander's. He was a cocky devil. Elizabeth liked cocky devils, just as she detested pompous jerks. There was only a subtle difference, but Paolo Roberto belonged to the former category. She now had an explanation for why he had suddenly sprung out of nowhere into the warehouse, but she was surprised that he'd decided so stubbornly to pursue the van. And she was frightened by the news that the police were digging up bodies in the woods around the warehouse.
"Thank you," she said. "You saved my life."
He shook his head and sat quietly for a while.
"I tried to explain it to Blomqvist. He didn't really get it. But I think you might understand, since you box yourself."
She knew what he meant. No one who hadn't been there would ever know what it was to fight a monster who couldn't feel pain. She thought about how helpless she'd been. After that, she had just held his bandaged hand. They didn't speak for a long time. There was nothing more to say. When she woke up, he was gone. She wished that Lisbeth would get in touch. She was the one Niedermann had been after. Miriam was afraid that he would catch her. Salander couldn't breathe. She had no sense of time, but she knew that she had been shot, and she realized, more by instinct than by rational thought, that she was buried underground. Her left arm was unusable. She couldn't move a muscle without waves of pain shooting through her shoulder, and she was floating in and out of a foggy consciousness.
"I have to get air."
Her head was bursting with a throbbing pain, the likes of which she had never felt before. Her right hand had ended up underneath her face, and she began instinctively to nudge the earth away from her nose and mouth. It was sandy and relatively dry. She managed to create a space the size of her fist in front of her face. How long she had been lying there buried, she had no idea, but finally she formulated a lucid thought, and it gripped her with panic.
"He buried me alive."
She couldn't breathe. She couldn't move. A vast weight of soil held her bound to the primal rock. She tried to move a leg, but she could scarcely tense her muscles. Then she made the mistake of trying to get up. She pressed down with her head to try to raise herself, and the pain flew like an electric charge through her temples.
"I can't throw up."
She sank back into muddled consciousness. When she could think again, she felt carefully to determine which parts of her body were functional. The only limb she could move an inch or two was her right hand, the one in front of her face.
"I have to get air."
The air was above her, above the grave. Salander began to scratch. She pressed down on her elbow and managed to make a little room to maneuver. With the back of her hand, she enlarged the area in front of her face by pressing the dirt away from her.
"I need to dig."
She discovered that she had a cavity within her fetal position, between her elbows and her knees. That was where most of the air that was keeping her alive had been trapped. She began desperately twisting her upper body back and forth, and felt how the soil ran into the space beneath her. The pressure on her chest lifted a little. She could move her arm. Minute by minute she worked in a semi-conscious state. She scratched sandy earth from her face and pressed handful after handful into the cavity beneath her. Gradually she managed to free her arm so that she could shift the soil away from the top of her head. Inch by inch she enlarged the space around her head. She felt something hard and was suddenly holding a small root or stick in her hand. She scratched upwards. The soil was still full of air and not very compact. The fox paused by Salander's grave on the way back to his den. He had found two field mice and was feeling satisfied when suddenly he sensed another presence. He froze and pricked up his ears. His whiskers and nose were quivering. Salander's fingers emerged like something dead from beneath the earth. Had there been any human watching, he would probably have reacted like the fox. He was gone like a shot. Salander felt cool air stream down her arm. She could breathe again. It took her half an hour more to free herself from the grave. She found it odd that she couldn't use her left hand, but mechanically went on scratching at the dirt and sand with her right. She needed something else to dig with. She pulled her arm down into the hole, got to her breast pocket, and worked the cigarette case free. She opened it and used it as a scoop. She scraped soil loose and flicked it away, and then at last she could move her right shoulder and managed to press it upwards through the earth above her. Then she scraped more sand and dirt and eventually was able to straighten her head. She now had her right arm and head above the ground. When she had released part of her upper body, she could start squirming upwards an inch at a time until the ground suddenly released its grip on her legs. She crawled from the grave with her eyes closed and didn't stop until her shoulder hit a tree trunk. Slowly she turned her body so that she had the tree to lean on, and wiped the dirt from her eyes with the back of her hand before she opened them. It was pitch black around her, and the air was icy cold. She was sweating. She felt a dull pain in her head, in her left shoulder, and in her hip, but didn't spend any energy wondering why. She sat still for 10 minutes, breathing. Then it came to her that she couldn't stay there. She struggled to her feet as the world swirled around her. She felt instantly sick and bent over to vomit. Then she started to walk. She had no idea which direction she was going. The pain in her left hip was excruciating, and she kept stumbling to her knees. Each time an even greater pain shot through her head. She didn't know how long she'd been walking when she saw a light out of the corner of her eye. She changed direction. It was only when she was standing by the woodshed in the yard that she realized she had walked straight back to Zalachenko's farmhouse. She swayed like a drunk. Photocells on the driveway and in the clearing. She had come from the other direction. They would not have noticed her. She was confused. She knew that she was in no condition to take on Niedermann and Zalachenko. She looked at the white farmhouse. Click. Wood. Click. Fire. She fantasized about a gasoline can and a match. With enormous effort, she turned towards the shed and staggered over to a door that was secured with a crossbar. She managed to lift it by putting her right shoulder under it. She heard the noise when the crossbar fell to the ground and hit the side of the door with a bang. She took a step into the darkness and looked around. It was a woodshed. There was no gasoline. At the kitchen table, Zalachenko looked up when he heard the sound of the falling crossbar. He pulled the curtain aside and peered out into the darkness. It was a few seconds before his eyes adjusted. The wind was blowing harder now. The weather forecast had predicted a stormy weekend. Then he saw that the door to the woodshed was ajar. He and Niedermann had brought in wood earlier that afternoon. It had been unnecessary, but its purpose was to provide Salander with confirmation that she had come to the right place and to draw her out. Niedermann had obviously not set the crossbar in place properly. He could be so phenomenally clumsy. Zalachenko glanced towards the door of the living room where Niedermann had dozed off on the sofa. He thought of waking him, but decided not to. To find gasoline, Salander would have to go to the barn, where the cars were parked. She leaned against the chopping block, breathing hard. She had to rest. She sat there for about a minute before she heard the halting steps of Zalachenko's prosthesis. In the dark, Blomqvist took a wrong turn at Melby, north of Sollebrunn. Instead of getting off at Nossebro, he had continued north. He realized his mistake just before he got to Trukorna. He stopped and looked at the map. He cursed and turned back towards Nossebro. With her right hand, Salander grabbed the axe from the chopping block a second before Zalachenko came into the woodshed. She didn't have the strength to lift it over her shoulder, but she swung it with one hand in an upward arc, putting her weight on her uninjured hip and turning her body in a semicircle. At the same moment that Zalachenko turned on the light switch, the blade of the axe struck him across the right side of his face, smashing his cheekbone and penetrating into his forehead. He didn't know what had happened, but in the next second his brain registered the pain and he howled as if possessed. Niedermann woke with a start and sat up, bewildered. He heard a screaming that at first he couldn't believe was human. It was coming from outside. Then he realized it was Zalachenko. He got swiftly to his feet. Salander planted her feet and swung the axe again, but her body was not obeying orders. Her aim was to bury the axe in her father's head, but she had exhausted all her strength and struck him far from the intended target, just below his kneecap. But the weight of the axe head buried it so deep that it stuck, and was pulled out of her hands when Zalachenko pitched forward into the shed. He was screaming incessantly. She bent again to grasp the axe. The earth shook as lightning flashed inside her head. She had to sit down. She reached out her hand and felt his jacket pockets. He still had the gun, and she focused her gaze as the ground swayed. A Browning 22 caliber.
A fucking Boy Scout pistol.
That was why she was still alive. If she'd been hit with a bullet from Niedermann's Sig Sauer, or from a revolver with heavier ammo, she would have a gigantic hole through her skull. At that moment she heard the stumbling approach of Niedermann, who then filled the doorway of the shed. He stopped short and registered the scene before him with uncomprehending and staring eyes. Zalachenko was wailing like a man possessed. His face was a bloody mask. He had an axe wedged in his knee. A bloody and filthy Salander was sitting on the floor next to him. She looked like something from a horror movie, and far too many of those had already played out in Niedermann's mind. He, who could feel no pain, and was built like a tank, had never liked the dark. With his own eyes he had seen creatures in the dark, and an indeterminate terror was always lurking, waiting for him. And now the terror had materialized. The girl on the floor was dead. There was no doubt about that. He had buried her himself. Consequently, the creature on the floor was no girl, but a being from the other side of the grave who couldn't be conquered with human strength or weapons known to man. The transformation from human being to corpse had already begun. Her skin had changed into a lizard-like armor. Her bared teeth were piercing spikes for ripping chunks of meat from her prey. Her reptilian tongue shot out and licked around her mouth. Her bloody hands had razor-sharp claws 4 inches long. He could see her eyes glowing. He could hear her growling low and saw her tense her muscles to pounce at his throat. He saw clearly that she had a tail that curled and ominously began to whip the floor. Then she raised the pistol and fired. The bullet passed so close to Niedermann's ear that he could feel the lash of the wind. He saw her mouth spout flames at him. That was too much. He stopped thinking. He spun around and ran for his life. She fired another shot that missed him, but that seemed to give him wings. He hopped over a fence and was swallowed up by the darkness of the field as he sprinted towards the main road. Salander watched in astonishment as he disappeared from view. She shuffled to the doorway and gazed into the darkness, but she couldn't see him. After a while, Zalachenko stopped screaming, but he lay moaning in shock. She opened the pistol, checked that she had one round left, and considered shooting him in the head. Then she remembered that Niedermann was still there, out in the dark, and she had better save it. She would need more than one 22 bullet for him. But it was better than nothing. It took her 5 minutes to put the crossbar in place. She staggered across the yard and into the house and found the telephone on a sideboard in the kitchen. She dialed a number she hadn't used in 2 years. The answering machine clicked in. "Hi, this is Mikhail Blomqvist. I can't answer right now, but please leave your name and number and I'll call you as soon as I can." Beep.
"Mikhail,"
she said, and heard that her voice sounded like mush. She swallowed.
"Mikhail, it's Salander."
Then she did not know what to say. She hung up the receiver. Niedermann's Sig Sauer lay disassembled for cleaning on the kitchen table in front of her, and next to it Sonny Niemannen's P-83 Vanut. She dropped Zalachenko's Browning on the floor and lurched over to pick up the Vanut and check the magazine. She also found her Palm PDA and dropped it in her pocket. Then she hobbled to the sink and filled an unwashed cup with cold water. She drank 4 cups. When she looked up, she saw her face in an old shaving mirror on the wall. She almost fired a shot out of sheer fright. What she saw reminded her more of an animal than a human being. She was a mad woman with a distorted face and a gaping mouth. She was plastered with dirt. Her face and neck were a coagulated gruel of blood and soil. Now she had an idea what Niedermann had encountered in the woodshed. She went closer to the mirror and was suddenly aware that her left leg was dragging behind her. She had a sharp pain in her hip where Zalachenko's first bullet had hit her. His second bullet had struck her shoulder and paralyzed her left arm. It hurt. But the pain in her head was so sharp it made her stagger. Slowly she raised her right hand and fumbled across the back of her head. With her fingers, she could feel the crater of the entry wound. As she fingered the hole in her skull, she realized with sudden horror that she was touching her own brain, that she was so seriously wounded she was dying, or maybe should already be dead. She couldn't comprehend how she could still be on her feet. She was suddenly overcome by a numbing weariness. She wasn't sure if she was about to faint or fall asleep, but she made her way to the kitchen bench, where she stretched out and laid the unwounded right side of her head on a cushion. She had to regain her strength. But she knew that she couldn't risk sleeping while Niedermann was still at large. Sooner or later he would come back. Sooner or later Zalachenko would manage to get out of the woodshed and drag himself to the house. But she no longer had the energy to stay upright. She was freezing. She clicked off the safety on the pistol. Niedermann stood undecided on the road from Solibron to Nosibro. He was alone. It was dark. He had begun to think rationally again, and was ashamed that he had run away. He didn't understand how it could have happened, but he came to the logical conclusion that she must have survived.
Somehow she must have managed to dig herself out.
Zalachenko needed him. He ought to go back to the house and wring her neck. At the same time, he had a powerful feeling that everything was over. He had had that feeling for a long time. Things had started to go wrong, and kept going wrong from the moment Bureman had contacted them. Zalachenko had changed beyond recognition when he heard the name Lisbeth Salander. All the rules about caution and moderation he had preached for so many years had been blown away. Niedermann hesitated. Zalachenko needed to be looked after. If she hadn't already killed him. That meant there would be questions. He bit his lower lip. He had been his father's partner for many years. They had been good years. He had money put away, and he also knew where Zalachenko had hidden his own fortune. He had the resources and the skill required to drive the business forward. The sensible thing would be to walk away from all this and not look back. If there was one thing that Zalachenko had drummed into him, it was always to retain the ability to walk away, without sentimentality, from a situation that felt unmanageable. That was a basic rule for survival. Don't lift a finger for a lost cause. She wasn't supernatural, but she was bad news. She was his half-sister. He had underestimated her. Niedermann was torn. Part of him wanted to go back and wring her neck. Part of him wanted to keep running through the night. He had his passport and wallet in his pocket. He didn't want to go back. There was nothing at the farm he needed. Except perhaps a car. He was still hesitating when he saw the gleam of headlights approaching from the other side of the hill. He turned his head. All he needed was a car to get him to Göteborg. For the first time in her life, at least since she had been a little girl, Salander was unable to take command of her situation. Over the years she had been mixed up in fights, subject to abuse, been the object of both official and private injustices. She had taken many more punches to both body and soul than anyone should ever have to endure. But she had been able to rebel every time. She had refused to answer Teleborian's questions, and when she was subjected to any kind of physical violence, she had been able to slink away and retreat. A broken nose she could live with. But she couldn't live with a hole in her skull. This time she couldn't drag herself home to bed, pull the covers over her head, sleep for 2 days, and then get up and go back to her daily routine as if nothing had happened. She was so seriously injured that she couldn't cope with the situation by herself. She was so exhausted that her body refused to listen to her commands.
"I have to sleep for a while," she thought.
and suddenly she realized that if she closed her eyes and let go, there was a good chance she would never wake up again. She analyzed this conclusion and gradually came to understand that she didn't care. On the contrary, she felt almost attracted by the thought. To rest. To not wake up. Her last thoughts were of Miriam Wu.
"Forgive me, Mimi."
She was still holding Niemann's pistol, with the safety off, when she closed her eyes. Blomqvist saw Niedermann in the beam of his headlights from a long way off and recognized him at once. It was hard to mistake a blonde behemoth, built like an armor-piercing robot. Niedermann was running in his direction, waving his arms. Blomqvist slowed down. He slipped his hand into the outer pocket of his laptop case and took out the Colt 1911 government he had found on Salander's desk. He stopped about 5 yards away from Niedermann and turned off the engine before opening the car door and stepping out.
"Thanks for stopping," Niedermann said, out of breath. "I had a car accident. Can you give me a lift to town?"
He had a surprisingly high-pitched voice.
"Of course, I can see that you get to town," Blomqvist said. He pointed the gun at Niedermann. "Lie down on the ground."
There was no end to the tribulations Niedermann was having to suffer that night. He stared in puzzlement at Blomqvist. Niedermann was not the least bit afraid of either the pistol or the man holding it. On the other hand, he had respect for weapons. He had lived with violence all his life. He assumed that if somebody pointed a gun at him, that person was prepared to use it. He squinted and tried to take stock of the man behind the pistol, but the headlights turned him into a shadowy figure.
Police? He didn't sound like a cop. Cops usually identified themselves. At least that's what they did in the movies.
He weighed his chances. He knew that if he charged the man, he could take away the gun. But the man sounded cold and was standing behind the car door. He would be hit by at least one, maybe two bullets. If he moved fast, the man might miss, or at least not hit a vital organ. But even if he survived, the bullets would make it difficult and perhaps impossible for him to escape. It would be better to wait for a more suitable opportunity.
"Lie down now!"
Blomqvist yelled. He moved the muzzle an inch and fired a round into the ditch.
"The next one hits your kneecap,"
Blomqvist said in a loud, clear voice of command. Niedermann got down on his knees, blinded by the headlights.
"Who are you?"
he said. Blomqvist reached his other hand into the pocket in the car door and took out the flashlight he had bought at the gas station. He shone the beam into Niedermann's face.
"Hands behind your back," Blomqvist commanded, "and spread your legs."
He waited until Niedermann reluctantly obeyed the orders.
"I know who you are. If you even begin to do anything stupid, I'll shoot you without warning. I'm aiming at your lung below your shoulder blade. You might be able to take me, but it'll cost you."
He put the flashlight on the ground and took off his belt and made a noose with it, exactly as he'd learned 2 decades earlier as a rifleman in Kiruna when he did his military service. He stood between the giant's legs, looped the noose around his arms, and pulled it tight above the elbows. The mighty Niedermann was, for all practical purposes, helpless. And then what? Blomqvist looked around. They were completely alone on a road in the dark. Aldo Roberto hadn't been exaggerating when he described Niedermann. The man was huge. The question was only why such a massive guy had come running in the middle of the night as if he were being chased by the devil himself.
"I'm looking for Lisbeth Salander. I assume you met her?"
Niedermann did not answer.
"Where is Lisbeth Salander?"
Niedermann gave him a peculiar look. He didn't understand what was happening to him on this strange night, when everything seemed to be going wrong. Blomqvist shrugged. He went back to the car, opened the trunk, and found a neatly coiled rope. He couldn't leave Niedermann tied up in the middle of the road, so he looked around. 30 yards further along the road, he saw a traffic sign in the headlights. Caution. Moose crossing.
"Get up."
He put the muzzle of the gun against Niedermann's neck, led him to the sign, and forced him into the ditch. He told Niedermann to sit with his back against the pole. Niedermann hesitated.
"This is all quite simple," Blomqvist said. "You killed Doug Svensson and Mia Johansson. They were my friends. I'm not going to let you loose on the road, so either you sit here while I tie you, or I'll shoot you in the kneecap.
Your choice. Niedermann sat. Blomqvist ran the tow rope around his neck and tied his head securely to the pole. Then he used 50 feet of rope to bind the giant fast around the torso and waist. He saved a length to tie his forearms to the pole and finished off his handiwork with some real sailor's knots. When he was finished, he asked again where Salander was. He got no reply, so he shrugged and left Niedermann there. It wasn't until he was back in the car that he felt the adrenaline flowing and realized what he had just done. The image of Johansson's face flickered before his eyes. Blomqvist lit a cigarette and drank some water out of the bottle. He looked at the figure in the dark beneath the moose sign. Then he looked at the map and saw that he had about half a mile before the turning off to Carl Axel Bodin's farm. He started the engine and drove past Biedermann. He drove slowly past the turn-off with the sign to Gosseberger and parked next to a barn on a forest road 100 yards further north. He took his pistol and turned his flashlight on. He found fresh tire tracks in the mud and decided that another car had been parked in that same place earlier, but he didn't stop to consider what that might mean. He walked back to the turn-off and shone light on the mailbox. P.O. Box 192, K.A. Bodin. He continued along the road. It was almost midnight when he saw the lights from Bodin's farmhouse. He stood still for several minutes but heard nothing other than the usual nighttime sounds. Instead of taking the road straight to the farm, he walked along the edge of the field and approached the building from the barn, stopping in the yard about 100 feet from the house. His every nerve was on edge. The fact that Niedermann had been running away was reason enough to believe that some catastrophe had occurred here. Suddenly he heard a sound. He spun around and dropped to one knee with his gun raised. It took him a few seconds to identify the source. One of the outbuildings. Somebody moaning. He moved quickly across the grass and stopped by the shed. Peering round the corner, he could see a light inside. He listened. Somebody was moving around. Holding the pistol in front of him, he lifted the crossbar with his left hand, pulled open the door, and was confronted by a pair of terrified eyes in a blood-streaked face. He saw the axe on the floor. "Holy shit," he said. Then he saw the prosthesis. Salachenko. Salander had definitely paid him a visit. But Blomqvist couldn't imagine what must have happened. He closed the door and replaced the crossbar. With Zalachenko in the woodshed, and Niedermann bound hand and foot beside the road to Sollebrunn, Blomqvist hurried across the courtyard to the farmhouse. It was possible that there was a third person who might yet be a danger, but the house seemed unoccupied, almost abandoned. Pointing his gun at the ground, he eased open the front door. He came into a dark hall and saw a rectangle of light from the kitchen. The only sound was the ticking of a wall clock. When he reached the door, he saw Salander lying on the kitchen bench. For a moment he stood as if petrified, staring at her mangled body. He noticed that she was holding a pistol in her hand, which hung loosely off the edge of the bench. He went to her side and sank to his knees. He thought about how he had found Svensson and Johansson, and thought that she was dead, too. Then he saw a slight movement in her chest, and heard a feeble, wheezing breath. He reached out his hand and carefully loosened the gun from her grip. Suddenly her fist tightened around its butt. She opened her eyes to two narrow slits and stared at him for many long seconds. Her eyes were unfocused. Then he heard her mutter in such a low voice that he could only with difficulty catch the words.
"Kalle fucking Blomqvist."
She closed her eyes and let go of the gun. He put it on the floor, took out his mobile, and dialed the number for emergency services. This is Simon Vance. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Girl Who Played With Fire, by Stieg Larsson. Translated from the Swedish by Reg Keeland. Translation copyright 2009 by Reg Keeland. Originally published in Sweden as Flickan som lekte med elden, by Norstedts, Stockholm, in 2006. Copyright 2006 by Norstedts Agency. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.